My name is Ray McGovern. I worked for the CIA for 27 years as an analyst. My graduate degree was in Soviet policy, and that's what I focused on for the first 7 or 8 years of my career. My responsibilities became much wider as my career advanced, and toward the end of my career, I was doing things like chairing national intelligence estimates and writing and actually briefing the daily president's brief, which we did for the president 6 days a week. That was really responsible duty. Both of those functions were sort of what I had hoped to achieve in the CIA, and I retired when that had been done and when the Soviet Union imploded, and my favorite substantive target disappeared as it used to be. I was speaking at a major event just last week, and I was sitting in the back putting my notes together, and two gentlemen came in. One pointed at me, the other one said, he doesn't look like a spy. And you know, that's happened before. I never know whether to be crestfallen or you know, happy about that. But it does point up a real problem, and that is that most people get their idea about what the CIA is all about from the movies or from TV. And really, that's an inaccurate view of what the CIA is really supposed to be doing. It was set up in 1947, after the war, for two reasons. That there be no new Pearl Harbor, where, as some of you will remember, little bits and pieces of information were available to the code breakers and the Navy and the Army Air Corps and the embassy and so forth. Nobody was centrally located in possession of all of those pieces of paper to make sure that they could make sense out of it. So the central part was essential. Okay. The other part was President Truman wanted one place where he could go and say, look, Mr. Director, I want you to tell me like you think it is. You and those two universities worth of specials you have out there in the woods of Virginia, I want to know what you really think. Give it to me straight. I'm not putting you under the State Department. I'm not putting you under the Pentagon. You're independent. You answer to me and to me alone. You can brief Congress, but I give you your job. You tell me the way it is. And I have to say that we had career protection for doing precisely that for most of the 27 years that I worked in those ranks. Those are the two primary purposes. Central place, telling it like it is. Now, most people know the CIA for completely different functions, and they have to do with what we call covert action. What's covert action? That's things like overthrowing the government of Iran in 1953, Guatemala in 1954, starting wars in Central America, that kind of thing. Okay, now, how does the CIA get off doing that? Well, it's kind of a long story, and I'll compress it, but while the CIA National Security Act was drafted in 1947, coming home from the European theater and from the Far East were people who had done incredibly imaginative, gutsy things for the Office of Strategic Services, OSS. And the question was, you know, do we need this kind of covert action capability anymore? And the question answered itself with the Russians overrunning Eastern Europe, threatening the Balkans, Italy and France even. And so it was decided, yeah, we need this capability to counter this kind of KGB offensive. And then the question came, well, where will we put it? What will we do? And that was the major mistake that was made. Somebody said, well, we're creating the CIA, so let's put it there. So you end up with what I call a birth defect. You know, it's a structural fault. You have one person, the director of CIA, responsible for objective intelligence, telling it like it is, and then you're going to give him, in the words of the National Security Act of 1947, the responsibility for performing other such duties as the president shall from time to time direct. Well, if the president can tell Bill Casey in the 80s to start a war in Central America and run the Contras, and Casey goes up to Congress and Congress says, now give it to us straight, how's that war going? What kind of credibility does Casey have? So it's a structural fault. It's really a two-agency kind of thing where the premium is on integrity at the top. I worked under 9 directors, and most of them faced up to that challenge. They still were able to tell it like it was, and we still had career protection for telling it like it was. Now, every now and then, a director would get a person like Henry Kissinger so ticked off at him that Kissinger would fire him. That happened to Bill Colby. And that happened to Bill Colby because he was a principled person. He wouldn't lie to Congress. He wouldn't cover up for the errors that had been made on Chile and the fact that his predecessor had lied to Congress. So you get people with real integrity, but lately we haven't had any. We haven't had any like that for 25 years, and that's a very, very sad story. It's really amazing. People still resist the notion that oil is the reason for Iraq. And it's 10 years from now, historians will be smirking at the notion that we couldn't understand that, you know. And even now, I think if you ask people the question, well, do you think we'd be in Iraq if there were no oil under the sand? I think most ill-informed Americans would say, well, I guess not, but we do need the oil. Now, this, I think, is the most sinister part of the whole thing, you know. We hear a lot about they're trying to destroy our way of life, okay. What does that mean? That means more than $3 a gallon, you know. I had a very well-heeled person come up to me in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, a rich suburb of Milwaukee, after I was finished talking for an hour about the peak oil problem and other things. He says to me, Mr. McGovern, what's your problem? I mean, would you tell me what your problem is? You don't dispute the fact that we need the oil, do you? I said, of course not. I mean, that was half of my speech. He says, then you have to admit that 3 or 4 GIs killed every week is a very small price to pay for the oil that we need. Now, there were 30 people around here. This was not a one-on-one sort of thing. I never heard anyone articulate it so bluntly, okay? Now, I think, I don't know, but I think underneath the top layer of people's brains in this country, they connect that with destroying our way of life. We do need the oil. In Vietnam, as this gentleman said, we were losing hundreds every week, 3 or 4 weeks. Well, it's too bad. But after all, who are these kids? Most of them come from towns in this country of less than 10,000 people. So they don't have any future anyway, you know? Why should I bother my pretty little head, as one woman once said, to worry about these folks? It's just insidious. So I said to him, I said to the media, I said, well, suppose one of those 3 killed last week was your son. And he bristled and he said, it wouldn't be my son. And that's the problem. That's the problem. It wouldn't be his son. You know, I talked to people in Arlington or Bethesda, affluent suburbs of this country. I asked them, how many people here, audience of, let's say it's Kiwanis, 300 people, how many have a son or a daughter or immediate relative in Iraq? Nobody. How many know somebody in Iraq? Maybe 1 or 2 hands go up, okay? Now, I give the same speech in Greensboro at an African-American Baptist church. Guess how many hands go up? Half of them. And that's a telling tale. People were asking me yesterday, do I favor reinstitution of the draft? Well, I sure as heck do. I served in an army where doctors and lawyers and everybody had to serve. And I dare say that were that the case today, we wouldn't be making terrible mistakes with such ease in sending our poorer kids to Iraq. Mossadegh was freely elected, okay? He served almost 2 years as a freely elected, the first freely elected president of Iran ever. They were very proud of him. He was a pretty decent fellow, you know? But he made the big mistake of thinking that the oil under Iran's sands belonged to the Iranians. Can you imagine that, you know? He didn't know that it really belonged to the UK, to the British, and to us, you know? And so, you know, we got together with the British Secret Service, and this is Eisenhower, after all, you know. We went in there and caused the demonstrations that led to his overthrow. Now, the Iranians remember that, you know. They remember that. There is a grievance that has not been redressed, and it's part of their history. It's in their history books, okay? So now what's the situation? Well, we have a similar situation with respect to Iraq. And it's just clear as the nose on anyone's face that when Bush and Cheney came in, you know, people forget this. You know, they weren't concerned about terrorists. You know, they weren't concerned about weapons of mass destruction. I mean, Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell said as recently as right before 9/11 that Saddam Hussein didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. So they knew that, okay? What were they concerned about? What was the big problem in this country? Well, out here on the West Coast, people were running out of electricity, running out of energy, okay? And that's why the first thing the president did was say, okay, Dick, Uncle Dick, you go over there and get some people with you and figure out how we're going to solve this energy problem. Now, we're not allowed to know the names of the people who came, but it's a pretty sure thing that most of them were oil people. And so maybe Cheney started out by saying, anybody here know about alternative sources of energy? No, okay. Anybody know about, oh, you all know about oil, okay. Well, let's get the charts out of Iraq, which is precisely what they did, and carve up districts or carve up the little shares for British and U.S. firms. Now, why was that? That was because we were running out of energy, and for the first time in our country's history, we were importing more than half of the oil that we needed to use. Now it's up to 60-65%, okay? So Cheney, being an oil man, saying, well, you know, he actually said in a speech as CEO of Halliburton in 1999, he said, you know, people fault us for not discovering new areas for oil production, but you have to remember that the prize, his words, the prize lies in the Persian Gulf. That's where the prize lies. And unfortunately, it's dominated by governments that are hostile to us. Hello? Yeah. Well, what was this government in Iraq? Headed by a cruel dictator, right? No army to speak of. Suffering greatly under the sanctions. So the notion was we'd go in there and it would be a cakewalk, you know, and the people would greet us with open arms and cut flowers. We'd be sitting there on top of all that oil. We'd be able to create permanent military bases to protect all that. We'd have Chalabi or somebody like that recognizing Israel and making the whole place a democracy. Give me a break. You know, they never consulted my CIA colleagues and all that, but that was their pipe dream. But it had to do with oil, and that's why we don't talk about permanent military base. That adjective is banned now by the Pentagon. They're enduring military bases, okay? Reminds me of that old Irish song, believe me if all those enduring young military bases, you know, enduring, what's the difference between enduring and permanent? Maybe enduring sounds a little bit more endearing or something like that. You know, it's just really, really amazing. The folks who have trouble differentiating between Israel's interests and our own interests are part of the explanation as to why George Bush is doing the kinds of things he's doing. Those same people have this megalomania. You know, the U.S. is the sole remaining superpower in the world. That means it has power that it needs to throw into areas of the world that are crucial. What's more crucial than the Middle East, where all the oil is? And so we'd be, you know, we'd be remiss in our stature and our duty as the sole remaining superpower in the world. How many times have you heard that? Sole remaining superpower in the world comes just rolls off your tongue. If we didn't insert our power where it's needed, and we need the oil, and so we put it in there. Now, the other thing is that these folks don't really seem to understand why they hate us. You know, it's really incredible. Smart people, you know, Wolfowitz, Pearl, those folks. I mean, they're not dumb. And, you know, why they hate us is pretty clear, you know. I'll tell you a little vignette. I was at a concert in Alexandria, Virginia, and my wife pointed out at intermission that, whoop, there's Senator John Warner, walking alone outside there by the fountain. So I hustled out there, and I said, Senator Warner, you may not remember, but you owe me a favor. He says, what? I said, yeah, when you came to Moscow there in 1972 and finished up the Incidents at Sea Agreement, and the Bolshoi was having Swan Lake, I gave you my seat because you arrived late. He said, oh, really? Well, thank you for it. Did you get a seat? Yeah, I got a seat right behind you. But now, let me talk to you about what's going on. I said, you know, I'm really, I'm really concerned because people don't understand why they hate us. And he's, whoa. And then he's a very patrician guy. He's 80 years old now. He's got me by the arm there. He's walking along, we're strolling along, and he says, oh, well, why do they hate us? And I said, they hate us because of our identification with the policies of the Israeli right-wing government. That's why they hate us. And his grip started to get a lot tighter, and he said, you're right, but this is very complicated. And then it became like a vise. He said, I don't know what we can do about that. Distinguished senator from Virginia, 80 years old, what's he got to lose? And he's fearful, and I feel it in my own body about the fact that, yes, it's the problem, but it's insoluble. What can we do about it? So what we need to do about it is kind of look at what the effects are. And the way you defeat terrorism is the same way you defeat malaria. Now, as is well known, in malaria, you find the mosquitoes, right? You trace them back to the swamp where they breed, and then you station a platoon of sharpshooters around the swamp, and as the mosquitoes leave the swamp, you shoot them all, right? Well, so it is with terrorism, You don't win the battle of terrorism by shooting the terrorists as they leave the swamp. You find out where the swamp is and what the swamp is. And the swamp is the long list of unredressed grievances on the part of all people who have been oppressed in the Middle East and elsewhere. Palestinians first and foremost, now the Iraqis and others. And with instant communication these days, everyone learns of this right away. They watch it on TV every night, So when Rumsfeld, as he used to do, said, I don't understand why anybody would strap on some plastic around his belt and blow himself up just to kill somebody. I don't understand that. Well, all he has to do is look at Al Jazeera one night, and he'll understand. What will he see? You'll see U.S.-built fighter bombers, U.S.-built tanks, U.S.-built helicopter gunships, and U.S.-built bulldozers, wreaking havoc in not only Gaza, but in the West Bank. I wear this green armband that says Rachel Curry, April 10, 1979, March 16, 2003. There was a very courageous American girl who was not going to let six kids be bulldozed because they were in a Palestinian home. And what happened? After 6 hours, the Israeli bulldozer commander got the command, yeah, go ahead, run over and make sure you're back over too, so you make sure the deed is done. Now that's the kind of courage, and that's the kind of incident that everyone knows about in Gaza. It was in Gaza. And so what we need to do is prevent so many millions of people from having no hope, so many millions of people living for three generations in refugee camps, which are very much like concentration camps in Gaza. If we do that, then there's some sort of possibility we could get people to have some hope. I'm calling the Iraq war the first resource war of the 21st century. Certainly there have been other wars and other conflicts waged for the same ultimate reasons. What distinguishes this one is the number one, the deceitful way in which it was started. Of course, deceit plays a role in others as well, but the scale of this war and what I call the CDD diagnosis I give the president, CDD being compassion deficit disorder. He just, it's a sociopathic sort of thing. He does not seem to be able to identify with anyone's suffering, and neither does Cheney. And so what you have is an incredibly insensitive group of leaders at the top of our government who have surrounded themselves with a bunch of sycophants. And, I mean that literally. And not only the political hacks that changed the words of the NASA chief scientist's thing on global warming. I'm talking about the George Tenets that changed that shaped the intelligence to what they want the president wants to know. And I'm also talking about our high-ranking military. And that's sort of new. It happened a little bit in Vietnam. But if you read the reporting now on General Taguba's report on Abu Ghraib, you'll see that the highest-ranking military officers, the generals in our country, did their best to get rid of Taguba and to paper over the whole Abu Ghraib incident because they knew that generals like Sanchez and others not only knew about it, but were responsible for it. And that's new, and that's, you know, that's criminal. And when Taguba says, as he did after his conversation with General Abizaid in the back of some limousine, he said, Abizaid looked at me and he said, look, Taguba, that investigation that you ran, well, we're investigating that investigation, and we're investigating you. And Taguba told Seymour Hersh, he said, you know, after 32 years or whatever it was in the army, I realized I wasn't in an army anymore. I was in a mafia. Those are strong words coming from a dedicated public servant. And so Abizaid, you know, head of CENTCOM, how about Petraeus, you know? Well, I know people have the book on Petraeus, okay? When he was at West Point, I know a couple of people that taught him there. And he's described to me as a real comer, you know, a real riser. The kind that would, you know, marry the commandant's daughter, you know. As a matter of fact, he did marry the commandant's daughter, okay? And, you know, he takes this job, which, according to the book that he wrote or supervised about counterinsurgency, is an impossible job because he doesn't have the ratio of troops to insurgents, to really resistance. Doesn't have the ratio that he says himself, the required. Why does he take the job? Well, I think it's just to get the fifth star, okay? And what does he do as soon as he gets out there? He says, well, now this is not going to depend on military victory. It's got to be political and economic progress first. And that's what he said on the Sunday TV show, okay? And then the foreign minister of Iraq comes and tells Wolf Blitzer, well, you know, we can only make political and economic progress when there's a security situation that General Petraeus has made us more secure. And so you have Alphonse and Gaston, you know, all this stuff. We're being diddled, you know. The president has a timeline. 18 months is his timeline, okay? He doesn't want to have a definitive defeat. He wants to stave off a definitive defeat, and so does Cheney, until he's out of office, okay? And what he's doing, that's what the surge is all about, sending our young men and women into to fill the gaps until such time as we can get out of office. That's the sole, incredibly unconscionable reason for that. And that's why Petraeus is playing this game. And when he comes back in, you know, in September, we know what he's going to say. We haven't had the surge in place long enough to evaluate how well it's. And that, you know, if you look at what was said, January 11th, Defense Secretary Robert Gates before the Armed Services Committee, okay, the Senate, and he's asked, what about this surge? And he says, well, you know, we haven't really given a lot of thought to how long it would be, but I'm sure it's just a matter of months, and not as long as 18 months. Whoa. So that's January 11th. In March, Petraeus is saying, well, you know, we won't be able to judge the effectiveness of this until the fall. You know, Odierno, his next guy down, saying February of next year we might have a good handle on what. I mean, you know, in the Bronx we call it bait and switch. You know, it's very clear what's going on, and the whole purpose is to stave off definitive defeat until they're out of office. And you know what? It's not going to work. It's not going to work because there's going to be a Saigon, April 1975 exit from Iraq before these people are out of office. Remember where you heard it first. It's not a happy thing to predict. Well, one of the saddest things that I was forced to observe during my career at CIA was that we gradually gravitated from a culture where you told it like it was, you know, you spoke out without fear or favor, and where we had career protection for doing that, to a culture where political considerations started to impinge upon the objectivity of the analysis. And that began big time when Bill Casey came in as Ronald Reagan's director of the CIA. Now, he was a really smart fellow, and he was a great spy master for World War II, but the times had passed him by, and suffice it to say, he saw a Soviet under every rock, you know, he saw a Russian under every rock, and those analysts who said, "Oh, wait a second, Mr. Director, I see two Soviets there," well, they became branch chiefs, and the ones that saw three became division chiefs. It was almost that bad. And the ones that would say, "You know, I don't see any there at all," or, "You know, this is really kind of propaganda spread by rightists in this particular country," they didn't get advanced at all. Many of them left. Robert Gates, who is now the Secretary of Defense, worked for me during the 70s as one of my analysts on the Middle East, actually. And he very quickly learned the way up in the agency, and by the time Casey came 10 years later, he was ready. And he became the head of analysis under Casey, and it was he and Casey that politicized analysis first and foremost on the Soviet Union. And that, of course, is why the CIA missed the fall of the Soviet Union. It just couldn't happen because these commies were commies forever. The party would never lose its place in the Soviet structure. And so even though analysts working there under these folks knew full well that Gorbachev, for example, was for real, that we really ought to pursue this glasnost, this perestroika, this whole opening of the Soviet system, they were prevented from saying so. Now, I left it about that time, as it was starting to get pretty bad. But what's the result of all that? Well, the way you politicize an institution like this is you get what I call malleable managers. Okay, you get people who are more interested in sniffing the prevailing winds from the White House or from the seventh floor, and you trim your analytical sails accordingly. Okay, and there are far too many of those folks, and they, of course, got moved ahead and became the managers. And this is true in any bureaucracy, but it didn't happen to be true before that in the CIA. And what happened then when the new president came in and kept George Tenet on and decided he wanted to make a war on Iraq? Well, George Tenet was the beneficiary, if you can use that word, of a whole new culture of malleable managers who would salute no matter what they were told to do. So, for example, in the summer of 2002, months after the decision for war had already been made, there had been no national intelligence estimate. Now, national intelligence estimate is the kind of product, it's the supreme genre of intelligence analysis. It's always done before a key political decision in foreign affairs is made and implemented. On Vietnam, they would always ask for an estimate before they would start a new campaign of bombing or some new tactic. In this case, no estimate was requested by the White House, and no estimate was offered by George Tenet. Why? Because an honest estimate on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq would have said, well, we know that 90% were destroyed right after the Gulf War. We have lists of other things, but we've never seen them. We've never seen them in satellite photography or intercepted communications. So we don't know if they exist, but they're on this list. And that would have been what would be served up, but that's not what the president wanted, and so it's better to do nothing than do that. Well, when they decided to ask Congress to approve this war, and the Democrats, by the way, were in charge of the Senate at that point in time, but Bob Graham from Florida, who was the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, he was kind of sleepy in one sense, and in another sense, he was distracted because he wanted to run for president, you know, so he let this sort of slip by. Dick Durbin, one of the people on the committee, said, "Hey, Bob, they want us to vote for war, and we don't even have an estimate on whether there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, like they say, or if there are, whether they're real danger to anybody. So don't you think we ought to ask for it?" And...
Yeah, I guess,
So he calls Tenet. He says, "Hey, how about an estimate on weapons of mass destruction?" This is the middle of September 2002. And you know what Tenet says? He says, "I'm sorry, Senator, but we're too busy. We're, you know, too busy doing other stuff." And Graham says, "Oh, okay," and hangs up. Durbin says, "What'd he say?" He says, "He's too busy." "Man, that won't work. Call him back and say he's got to do it." Graham called back, "Well, you know, we really need one if you want us to vote for war." So what does Tenet do? Tenet says, "Well, okay, I'll check this out." He goes to the White House. He says, "Looks like we can't avoid this estimate any longer. What should I do?" And the politicos there, I'm sure it was Karl Rove and Andy Card and that whole court, and Cheney. "Well, okay, you go back and do an estimate, but it's got to come out the way Dick Cheney said it was on the 26th of August, 2002. Now, estimates usually take a couple of months. Why 3 weeks? Because we want to force the Democrats to vote on this before the midterm elections. Best timing would be early October. Now, Tenet, to the disgrace of himself and to the whole intelligence profession, says, "Okay. Okay," he says. And he goes back to headquarters and he explains the conditions to the people, his managers around the table. Now, if he had done that in our day, you know, it said, you know, we have to do it 3 weeks and we have to do it according to what the Vice President says is the situation with weapons minister tracking, we would have said, "George, that's really good, George. George, you're kidding, right? You're serious, George? Sorry, we don't do that." We would have got up from that table and walked out of it. You know, I'm convinced, I would have, and I'm sure that a handful of others, some would have made a stay, but he would have known. He would have known that he had insurrection on his hands. Instead, what he's the beneficiary of is this politicization process started in 1982. Now it's 2002. So you got 20 years of these people being moved up and the people around there said, "Yes, sir, 3 weeks, we can do that." Now, who was put in charge of this estimate? A fellow named Robert Walpole, whose claim to fame was that he orchestrated an estimate in 1998 that did Donald Rumsfeld's bidding. Donald Rumsfeld wanted to make out Korea, North Korea, to be a big threat to us, a rogue regime that could get an ICBM, and so obviously we'd need a national missile defense to protect against that, okay? And the serious analyst said North Korea couldn't get that kind of capability for 15 years, okay? Well, Rumsfeld objected, and he persuaded Clinton to appoint Robert Walpole to do a different estimate. And he did an estimate that says, no, the North Koreans could have this capability by 2002. Dead wrong, of course, okay? But Walpole had proved that he could do what he was required to do. Now, in Tenet's book, for some reason, Tenet says, "So I appointed Robert Walpole, who, by the way, is a Mormon bishop who often comes to work on a motorcycle." Well, okay. What the heck does that have to do with being in charge of an estimate? Well, Walpole did what he thought was his duty, and the others did too. And what emerged from that was the very worst national intelligence estimate ever produced by any intelligence organization that I know of. The national intelligence estimate dated October 1st, 2002, about the continuing weapons of mass destruction program in Iraq was the worst estimate that the intelligence community ever produced. It was produced for one reason only, and that was that the president had been advised by his advisors that he ought to do what his dad did, and that is seek congressional approval before waging war in Iraq. And so he said, you know, this will be a piece of cake. Let's do an estimate. Now, if George Tenet were doing his job, he would have said at that point, you know, if we do an honest estimate, you know, we don't have much to go on. You know, this cockamamie story about Iraq seeking uranium in Niger, I'm sorry I got you all excited about that, but you know, we find out that it's false on its face because it didn't need this stuff. It already had some in the country. Besides that, it couldn't get it out of Niger because the French control it. But now we know that it's based on forgery. So, you know, that's what he should have said, okay? But he didn't. And so that cockamamie report found its way into the estimate, okay? That's why Condoleezza Rice and Stephen Hadley could say months later, well, we put it into President's speech because it was in the estimate. Now, the estimate was dated the 1st of October. 3 days later, the head of the CIA, George Tenet, called the White House furiously and said, look, get that portion out of the president's speech that he's going to give on the 7th of October. This is the one with the mushroom cloud, you know? 7th of October, the president says, the first sign we might have that Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons would be coming in the form of a mushroom cloud. Condoleezza Rice says it the next day. Victoria Clark says it the following day. And on the 10th and the 11th of October, right on schedule, right on Karl Rove's schedule, the Congress is forced to vote on whether or not to give the president permission for war. Nice 4 weeks before the election, okay? And, you know, the culpability is widely shared because George Kennan is quite right. Even though he was 90 years old at the time, he said that the performance of Congress was shabby and shameful. Not many of them really looked and asked the right questions. They were all afraid that they would suffer the fate of those Democrats who voted against the first glorious Gulf War, okay? They caved in other words. So intelligence plays a really vital role in all this, and in this case, intelligence was used, it was corrupted. I would say that we feel a lot of pain about this corruption because that's our profession, okay? But we feel much more pain. Most of us are fairly conservative types. And we feel kind of strongly about the oath we took to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States. And we see one branch of our government deliberately corrupting our profession with the objective of deceiving another branch out of its constitutional prerogative to declare war or otherwise authorize war. Well, that's as bad as it gets. It doesn't get any worse than that. That's why we set up this movement, which we call Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and had three memos out before the war warning the president precisely what would happen if he embarked on this misadventure. The CIA's role, as I understood it to be, and as it is in legislation, was to tell it like it is. And for the most part, we were able to do that. I had career protection for doing that. And I was in rather responsible positions in the 70s, for example, when Bill Colby and George Bush were head of the CIA. And we lived up to those capabilities. If you think some of the crazy things that happened were crazy, you're quite right when Kissinger was running things. But I can tell you that there were still more crazy things that we nipped in the bud when we learned about them, not from Kissinger, but from our own sources. And Colby would have the guts to say to people like me, McGovern, you go down and tell Henry Kissinger what we think about this. Number one, that we're onto it, and number two, that it has no prospect for success, and number three, that we're writing that in the next president's daily brief for tomorrow morning, okay? So I'd go down there, and Henry would see me, you know, and I'd say, well, you know, listen to me, and he'd say, well, thank you very much, that'd be enough, and so I'd go back. And this happened, you know, I'm back to the headquarters. 5 minutes later, Colby comes into my office. He says, Ray, how'd it go? I said, well, sir, I don't think I got very far with Kissinger at all. He said, well, did you tell him what we agreed he needed to, that we needed to tell him? I said, oh, yes, sir, I did. He said, all right, good. I'm proud of you. That's all we're supposed to do. You know, just tell them what we think, okay? They're going to make their own decisions anyway. But I'm proud of you. He shakes my hand. He walks out, and I say, what a bizarre place is this to work. I just got my boss in deep kimchi, in deep trouble with his boss, Henry Kissinger, to all intents and purposes, his boss. And he's not only not beating me about the head and mouth for it, I'll probably get a promotion out of this, which I did, okay? Now, that was the ethos at its best, okay? The other directors were very, very different. And when you get down to Bob Casey, when you get down to Bill Casey and Bobby Gates, it's interesting that I get the names mixed up because they were proteges one of the other. Then it becomes problematic because it was Gates that commissioned that estimate on the moderates in Iran. There weren't any moderates in Iran, but they needed to justify giving weapons to them, and so, well, maybe this would help the moderates. So, yeah, that was politicization of intelligence. Similarly, with the assassination attempt on the Pope, Casey was convinced the Soviets did it. My friends, I was not working in the Soviet area at that time, looked through all the evidence, exhaustively, and came up with a sensible memo saying, no, it wasn't the Soviets. It wasn't even the Bulgarians. It was this crazy, crazy Turk, or whatever he was. Casey ripped it up, sent it back. That won't do. Do it again. They did it again, same conclusion. So you know what he did? He picked out five malleable analysts, people who were more interested in getting ahead than coming at the truth, and he gave them the information, all the source material on this issue, and put them over in a different part of the building and said, I'm sure you guys can do better. And guess what? The Bulgarians probably were responsible, and they wouldn't do anything without the Soviets, so the Soviets really responsible. And that's what went down to the White House. Now, that's inexcusable. And it's incredibly demoralizing for somebody trying to do an honest job. But those were the exceptions. Those were the exceptions until Casey came in, until Gates, and then the reporting on Central America, for example, was distorted. And that's when I left. There were abuses here, and especially when Casey came in, it was very difficult to tell it like it was when Casey was running operations, like in Nicaragua. There were times when we were able to prevail on the director not to run a covert operation. Now, Colby had experience on the operations side as well as knowing a lot about the substantive side. He instituted a procedure whereby people like me and people working on the substantive side would be given a covert action proposal and asked to comment on it. Now, I don't know if that's been done since then. That was a unique introduction of new review. But we were able to pronounce sensibly about these things from a substantive point of view, so you didn't have a bunch of cowboys going off doing what they can because they can, So there was a sort of check on that, and as I say, we were free to we're free to speak our minds, even in very high circles. Now, I'll give you an example of what happened around the mid-70s when Turkey invaded Cyprus. You remember that? Yeah, 75 and then 74. And of course, it used U.S. weaponry to do that. And so there was an embargo put on more further arms to Turkey. Well, Kissinger was in high dudgeon. He was just completely, it became a war between Kissinger and Congress, And the whole government was saying, oh, these darn Greeks, they're so unreasonable and the Greek lobby is so powerful. This is a terrible embargo. Look what's going to happen. And so I'm the National Intelligence Officer in Western Europe. I say, okay, tell me what's going to happen. Well, Turkey is the anchor for Western Europe and for NATO, and what will happen to Turkey? I say, yeah, well, you tell me what's going to happen to Turkey. Well, I say, well, maybe it was just too ridiculous to suggest that Turkey's going to go to the Soviet Union. I mean, they wouldn't even say that. Or maybe, oh, I don't know, maybe, I don't know what happened. I said, well, where can the Turks go for their weaponry, Well, 95% comes from us. Okay, what can the Turks do? Well, they could close down our intelligence collection facilities. Okay, what are they worth? Well, push comes to shove, they weren't worth much at all, just like those missiles we had in Turkey weren't worth much during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I was able to get a memorandum out saying, Henry Kissinger, I didn't say this, but it was the environment was Henry Kissinger was beating on Congress for this unconscionable embargo, which is going to lose Turkey to NATO. And this memo says, Turkey's got no way to go. We don't even need the facilities that they threatened to shut down. So relax, see how it works out. And besides, I wasn't able to get this in the memo, but besides, I thought, you know, we have this law. We have a country of law. And when we give weaponry to a country like Turkey, there's a stipulation that they won't use it to invade other countries. You know, I think that's a good law. And I don't think it should be just sort of prescinded from or dismissed out of hand, especially since that's a volatile part of the world. And I would like the Israeli government to sit up and take notice that, you know, countries that invade other countries with U.S. weapons, maybe it's not such a good idea, you know? Well, you imagine how that went over in the policy councils of our government. But the point is, I was able to say that, you know? And I was the only one, but I think it made a lot of sense. And, you know, were we to have made that law stick in a painful way, there's still just an outside chance, but there's still a chance that the Israelis would take us seriously when we make laws saying, please don't use our weapons to beat up on other countries. You know, there's an inscription on the wall of the CIA. The CIA was just constructed before I came on duty under President Kennedy in 1963. And the headquarters building had just been, it wasn't even full up yet. You know, it was just getting, but it was finished. And the marble entrance had on the wall inscribed this message chiseled into the marble, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." When I saw that, you know, I said, reverberating in my mind was something my grandmother said to me. If she said once, she said it about 100 times. "Raymond, be truthful and honest, and then you won't give a damn what anyone says about you." Okay? I looked at that thing and I said, "Grandma, if that's true," no pun intended, "if that's true, this is going to be a good place to work." And it was. It was. Up until it started to peter out when Casey started this politicization stuff. And it can be again. What you need is integrity at the top, somebody who's a self-made person, unlike George Tenet. If you want to know the qualities necessary for a good director of the CIA, just look at George Tenet and pick somebody with all the opposite qualities. No experience in the most highly politicized environment you can imagine, Congress. A self-made person out of the government, a person who doesn't need the job, a person who has the integrity and guts to tell it like it is, and a person who's experienced in managing a very large operation. Now, on all of those things, of course, Tenet had no qualifications, but that's the kind of person that can bubble up to the top under people who either don't know any better or see in him a kind of a malleable person who won't cause any trouble. And maybe my last comment on this would be, how do you get the job? Well, we sort of knew how he got the job. Clinton couldn't find anybody to replace Andy Lake, who he wanted to make the new DCI. So he was sort of the third try, and he had been a deputy there. But why was he kept on under the new administration? Very unusual for a head of the CIA to continue in office from one Democratic administration to Republican administration. Well, I'll tell you what I think. Robert Gates, now the defense secretary, was very close to the first President Bush. He was actually his head of the CIA. And so when Tenet wanted to know, well, what's this fellow Tenet? And when, George W. Bush wanted to know what Tenet was like, he would ask Gates. Now, Gates owed Tenet big time, because when Gates was nominated by President George Herbert Walker Bush to be head of the CIA, he was under very, very intensive scrutiny, not only for the role he played in Iran-Contra, but for his politicization of intelligence. And guess who is staff director of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the time? A fellow named George Tenet. Guess who it was that greased the skids to get that nomination out of committee where it could be voted on the floor of the Senate? A fellow named George W. Tenet. Did you know that 31 senators voted against Gates? 31, unprecedented, okay, but Tenet did the job. Now, so Gates says to George W. Bush, Tenet's all right, you know, he'll do what you need to have done, he won't cause you any problems. And if the president was talking to his father at the time, his father probably would have told him the same thing. And so, you know, that's really sort of this incestuous relationship that really hangs on, and now, of course, Gates is brought back as Secretary of Defense. So, you know, if you ingratiate yourself with the right people, and Tenet was an expert at that, when he was nominated, his big cachet was said to be that he was equally popular on both sides of the aisle, okay? Now, in Washington, that's a big cachet, usually. But in the intelligence business, that's the kiss of death, the kiss of death. Because if you tell it like it is, you're going to have enemies right and left. You're not going to be popular on either side of the thing if you tell the truth, okay? And so that was the warning signal number one when he was nominated. We knew that this was going to be a real hard slog. And of course, we didn't know the half of it. We didn't know how a man of little courage and little sense of duty or his oath to the Constitution, little conscience, really, would let himself be seduced into enabling an unnecessary war. And last thing I'll say is that people have asked me, could Tenet have prevented this war? I think Tenet and Powell, ideally, if they did it together, sure, they could have prevented. They both knew about the lies. Individually, I think there's a good chance that he could have, Tenet could have, or Powell. And the sad thing is that it probably didn't occur to them. Didn't even occur to them, to be honest, and speak to the American people and say, you know, I'm out of here. This is what's happening. Don't let them start this war.